Welcome to Holden Village. Ingrid Christiansen will be speaking on covered bridges, choosing to be child-free. So let's listen in on Ingrid.
The book that I'm going to read is a Barbara Kingsolver book, a short story called Covered Bridges. And it's a story of people who are trying to figure out whether or not they want to have children. I would like to begin by asking some questions of the authorities in this room. I'm interested to know your story or stories of people you know about why you decided to have or not to have children yourselves. Just brief stories. Is it something you thought about? Is it something you questioned? Is it something you decided to do or not do? Or is it something that happened automatically without thinking? How did that work in your lives?
Well, it was my parents both come from big families, Midwestern families, and they great family reunions and all ages of generations together, and it's just great. It's just great joy, and all the stories and all the letters that would come into my home, and this was just something I wanted to be part of, a big family which involved me and helping create the next generation.
So when you and Duane got married, you were assuming you'd have kids. Anybody else?
I think we never thought otherwise. I just thought that was going to be part of it and wanted to have children. And my husband was an only child, but I had brothers and sisters. And that's kind of, that was kind of assumed in that family, I think, too.
Mine just happened. There just wasn't effective birth control at that time, and none of them were actually planned. They all just happened. Now my children, each one of my three children have planned each of their children they've had.
So the next generation is really having to think about it.
The first one, I was working, and I really didn't, I really wouldn't have planned a child at that time. It was okay, but it was just... happened, and I guess I would not have planned it that way.
Mm-hmm. Does anybody else have a story they want to share about that?
I had children because I wanted to grow up again. I hope I have grandchildren and grow up again. That sounds stupid, but you grow, you look at children who stay young.
And you kind of go through their stages again.
Yeah, it's fun to watch them.
When they're infants, you cry a lot. And
yeah, sometimes.
Okay, I have another question. What do we think about couples who decide not to have children?
That they're sterile. Usually that they can't have them at the first thought.
Uh-huh. Any other thoughts?
Well, I have colleagues back home who have deliberately chosen not to have children, and I think it's because they wanted a less complicated life than they saw some other people having, and I alternately think they're selfish and I'm jealous of them.
This is a word I also have heard. Couples that choose not to selfish is the word, that it makes it much easier. You can do what you want to do, and life becomes very, the demands of the other little ones coming or don't allow you to do what you want to do. So sometimes I hear people say, oh, they're just selfish. And a lot of times I think, well, it's sure better to make that choice if you really don't want them. It would be much better to do with your life what's right for you.
Mm-hmm.
And to have a birth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad we have options.
The world is certainly full of enough kids in general, so.
Sometimes the people that have chosen not to have children, I can't imagine seeing with children.
Mm-hmm.
And
so it seems like
it's not that type that really enjoy children at all. And I think I'm glad they made the decision that they did.
There is a slight danger, though, because I also know folks. Nephew, who didn't want any children, and then kind of made the decision, well, let's have one after all. And they said, I had no idea this is what you felt like with this baby. I had no idea, because the youngster's 5 years old now. But they had no idea, because people can't tell you what it is. It is an experience.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the only danger in making that decision. To miss something is kind of neat.
Does anyone know anybody who decided to have a child or children who regrets it?
Actually, I do. I know someone who had planned not to have children, and while it was a bad relationship with the spouse, went ahead and had the baby, his baby anyway. And he does care for the child, but he still, I think, feels that he would rather have been childless.
Yeah, I know a number of people who regret having had children. Different categories of people. And it's very odd, because middle-class educated people find it very difficult to express that feeling, I think. It's really something that, because once you've got the kid there, how can you say, I love this child, but I didn't want to have children, and I still wish I didn't, although I love this child. But poor folks have an easier time talking about this. And poor folks, I mean, I remember when I first got pregnant, I was 32, you know, and this was a cherished, desired, wanted child. And we went to visit a poor family that we're close friends with on the west side of Chicago before Christmas visit. And the teenage girls, who all had their own children, you know, they start having kids when they're 14 or 15, the teenage girls said, you got pregnant on purpose? At your age, you made it through? Whatever made it through means, and you decided to get pregnant? They just couldn't imagine that I had made that decision. So some of it comes out of an economic place and a place of having freedom and choice. And I know a number of middle-class couples, or one in particular very close to us, who decided not to have children. And she says she would have been a terrible mother. She was not a happy child in her own childhood. She was not a happy teenager. She does not have happy relationships with her parents. And she thinks she would have been a terrible mom. I don't know if she would have or not. But there is some of that.
Well, I've seen lots of parents that shouldn't have them.
Yes, I have two people I wish hadn't had kids.
I work with a program with abused and neglected kids, and they're just... so many kids in this world that have terrible situations. Parents didn't want them, they've got them, and they just treat them terrible.
And they seem to me to be selfish to have had them.
Absolutely.
And you hear stories and read stories in the paper all the time about people who have had children taken away from them because they're abusive, and while the children are taken away, they're pregnant with another one, you know, which will not be taken away until they abuse that one. So there's so many ways of feeling sorry for people for either having had them or not having had them. Or I think there are very few ways in our culture to honor somebody for not having had kids. But I think that is something that we could think more about and think about why it's so hard for us to do that. Well, let's hear this story. It's pretty long, unfortunately, so it's going to take about a half an hour. I want to point out a few things that you might listen for while you're listening to the story. First of all, I think Barbara Kingsolver has wonderful, dense language. She's almost like a poet. She chooses her words extremely carefully. A lot of the story is about life and life forms. It's about a couple, a middle-class couple. And they are very... I would say they're much more conscious than most people I know about the kind of physical level of life. They're both their careers are involved in the physical level of life. One of them is a scientist, and I guess they both are in the sciences in some way. But they're very good at attaching a kind of, if you thought of the literal level of life, the physical level being sort of firm, it's like they've plowed there, so it's thicker. And then they can attach that thick, plowed, physical level of life to a much deeper spiritual and emotional level of life. So they're very interesting people, I think. the story has a lot of images about animals, minerals, and vegetables. And so listen to those animal, mineral, and vegetable things. There's a life cycle set of images in the story. The life cycle stuff is really strong. Kinds of life, animals, life cycles, death and rebirth, means of death, what rebirth and death is all about and what that means. So that whole set of things. And the kind of epitome of that is there's a lot of images of diatomaceous earth, which is earth. It's when you feel of it, it's almost like talcum powder. It's very fine. I think it's used to enrich the soil when you are doing like hydroponic gardening, when you're intensive gardening. It's a highly nutritious stuff. It's made out of crushed up skeletons of sea animals, shells. So it's earth made out of animals. But it's also deadly to bugs, because it's tiny little sharp things, and if bugs get into it, it kills them. So it's an interesting substance, diatomaceous earth. And it has, you know, it's animal and mineral almost. And it's both life-giving and death-giving. What does the title mean? It would be something I think you might think about, covered bridges. In literature, trips over water are kind of classic images. You know, as soon as the characters go over water, you know there's something important going on symbolically. And a bridge is obviously a bridge over troubled waters, or a bridge over water. And then adding a cover over a bridge might be another layer of imagery that would be interesting. So the fact that it's entitled Covered Bridges at a time when they're really consciously trying to make a decision in their lives, in the path of their life, is interesting. Then maybe one more set of the questions. They borrow a baby to try out having a baby. And what does the baby do? How does the baby act? How does the baby react to them? How does the baby act in their lives? What does the baby learn while it's with them for a couple days? All of those kinds of questions are kind of fun. I think it's a delightful story. I'm going to leave two pages out of it because it's a little too long. I'll summarize those pages quickly when we come to them. So we're off. Barbara Kingsolver, Covered Bridges. It starts out with a reference to life cycle. The first two words are last summer. Not this summer, but last summer. So we have seasonal stuff going on. Last summer, all our friends were divorcing or having babies, as if those were the only two choices. It's silly, I know, but it started us thinking. From there, our thoughts ran along a track that seemed to stop at every depot and have absolutely no final destination. Then there's the question of how many, said my wife Lena from the bedroom while I was brushing my teeth. If you have one, you almost have to have another one. People act like you're a criminal if you don't. The subject had threaded itself completely through our lives, like a snaking green vine through the boughs of a tree. If there was no formal introduction to the subject, if she didn't say, at work today, or, you know, I was thinking, then I knew it was this conversation we were having again. I rinsed my toothbrush and hung it in the brass ring next to Lena's. Isn't that getting the cart before the donkey? I asked. I suppose. I came into the bedroom where she was sitting up in bed with a book. She took off her glasses. Lena is 37 and an amazing person to see. Every man in love believes his wife is beautiful, I know, but I also know that people look at Lena and look again. She has long, very straight black hair with one lock of white streaming out like shooting stars above her high forehead. Every member of her mother's family has this forelock, which is controlled by a single dominant gene. But in Lena, that gene has found its perfect resting place. Whatever else there is to consider, she said, we both have to agree before going ahead with it. Either one of us has veto power. I assumed this meant that she was leaning toward, but that I was probably leaning against and ought to speak up. Most of the men I knew thought of their children as something their wives had produced, nurtured, and given to the world like tomatoes grown for the market. With Lena, it couldn't be this way. I don't know what I think, I said. I guess I've just assumed that if you really wanted children, I'd have no right to object. She looked surprised. If I wanted to do it solo, what's the point of being married? I could just use a turkey baster. Lena had a friend in St. Louis who had done just that. I know, I said, but it's hard for me to say what I really think. Lena's eyes are a very serious, oceanic shade of blue. What do you really think? She asked me. Well, I have to admit, the idea overwhelms me. To rock the boat, just when I feel like I've finally gotten my life arranged the right way. I considered this. From what I can tell, it's not even like rocking the boat. It's like sinking the boat and swimming for 18 years. I believe that. She started to say something, but didn't. But I'm not really sure, I said. I'll think about it some more. Good. She kissed me and turned out the light. It seemed odd to have this question arise in my life now, when other men my age were beginning to groan about the price of college tuition. I couldn't remember a time in life when I'd ever clearly visualized my own progeny. Lena and I came together relatively late in the scheme of things, without the usual assumptions people have about starting a family and a life. We bought a two-story house in the maple shade of Convocation Street and assembled our collective belongings there, but as for a life, which each of us already had one. I am nearly 40 and a professor of botany. Before I met Lena 3 years ago, I devoted myself entirely to opening young minds onto the mysteries of xylem and phloem. I teach the other half of the chicken and egg story, the miracle of life that starts with pollen and ends with the astonishing, completed fact of a fruit. Also, I'm a great gardener. Some would call it puttering, but I feel that I commune with nature in the tradition of many great thinkers, Thoreau, Whitman, Aristotle. My communion is simply more domestic. I receive inspiration from cauliflowers. I have always had friends among my colleagues, but never a soulmate. Back before Lena, I liked to think of myself as a congenial hermit in blue jeans and Nikes, a latter-day Gregor Mendel among his peas. Lena is a specialist in toxicology and operates a poison hotline at the county hospital. People from all over the state call her in desperation when their children have consumed baby aspirin or a houseplant or what have you, and she helps them. It might sound morbid, but no one could be more full of joy of life than Lena, even when her job is concerned. She's magnificent at parties. Her best story is about a Gila monster named Hilda, which served a brief term as the pet of the Norman Klinderback family. Hilda was an illegal gift from an uncle in Tucson and crossed our nation in a fiberglass container of the type meant for transporting cats. The Gila monster, by all rights a stranger to this part of Indiana, is a highly poisonous lizard, but is thought by most experts to be too lazy to pose a threat to humans. The incident precipitating the call to my wife involved a July 4th picnic in which Hilda was teased beyond endurance with a piece of fried chicken. Hilda had a bite of Norm Jr.'s thumb instead. Of course, the story ended happily. Lena wouldn't make light of someone else's grief, having suffered her own. Another thing that runs in her family, besides the white forelock, is a dire allergy to the stings of bees and wasps. In childhood, she lost her sister. Suddenly and incomprehensibly, this child passed over from life to death before Lena's eyes while they sat in the yard making clover necklaces. Lena could die by the same sword. Theoretically, any outdoor excursion that includes my wife could come to tragedy. But it was this aspect of her life that led her to the study of toxic reactions, and it was through the poison hotline that we met. I called because I had gotten diatomaceous earth in my eye. I don't know exactly how it happened, whether I rubbed my eye while I was working with it, or if it was carried by a gust of wind. The powder is light. What I remember most clearly is Lena's voice over the phone, concerned and serious, as if there were nothing on earth more important to her than preventing my cornea from being scratched. If things had gone another way, if I hadn't gathered the courage to call back the next week without the excuse of a poisoning, I might have become one of her stories. Instead, I became her husband. I called and explained to her what I'd been doing with diatomaceous earth, since I thought she might wonder. The name is poetic, but in fact, this substance is a lethal insecticide. I was dusting it onto the leaves of my eggplants, which had suffered an attack of flea beetles and looked as though they'd been pelleted with buckshot. I'm fond of eggplants for aesthetic reasons as much as any other. Really, I said to Lena, my future wife, could anyone ask for a more beautiful fruit? Over the phone, her laughter sounded like a warm bath. Our courtship was very much a vegetable affair. By way of thanks, I invited her to see my garden, and to my amazement, she accepted. She had never grown vegetables herself, she said, and it impressed her to see familiar foods, like cabbages, rooted to the earth. I showed her how Brussels sprouts grow, attached along the fat main stem like so many suckling pigs. She seemed to need to take in the textures of things, brushing her hands across velvety petals, even rubbing my shirt sleeve absently between her thumb and forefinger, as if to divine the essence of a botanist. I promised to cook her an eggplant rollatini by the time of the summer solstice. But before the shortest night of the year, I had already lain beside Lena, trembling, and confessed I'd never held anything I so treasured. Lena says I was the first poison victim ever to call back, except in the case of repeat offenders. And to think I nearly didn't. A person could spend most of a lifetime in retrospective terror, thinking of all the things one nearly didn't do. Diatomaceous earth, by the way, isn't dirt. It's a remarkable substance made up of the jagged silicone skeletons of thousands of tiny sea creatures. It feels to a human hand like talc, but to insects, it's like rolling on broken bottles. It lacerates their skin, so the vital juices leak out. This is a fearful way to die, I'm sure, but as I sprinkled the white powder around the leaves on that spring day, I wasn't thinking about the insects. I was thinking of eggplants, heavy and purple-black in the midsummer sun. I believe that, try as we might to see it differently, life nearly always comes down to choices like this. There is always a price. My elderly neighbor is fond of saying, as he stands at his mailbox, rifling through the bright-colored junk mail, if there's something on this earth that's really for free, I'd pay everything I got to know what it is. Lena thought that rather than just hypothesizing, it might be a good idea for us to actually try out a baby for a weekend. The more I thought about it, the more reasonable it seemed. In fact, I thought maybe it ought to be a requirement. In any event, our friends the McElroys were happy to oblige us with their daughter Melinda. They offered to drop her off Friday evening and head post-haste for Chicago. McElroy teaches zoology and has an office next to mine. Our college is small. The biology department is comprised solely of the two of us, one ambassador from each of the plant and animal kingdoms. McElroy came here from a state university and thinks this is extremely amusing. Sometimes in the restroom, he will stand at the next urinal and say, "Shall we convene a departmental meeting?" Which is not a joke to the McElroys. No, what is not a joke to the McElroys is that at the age of 20 months, Melinda still doesn't walk. At first they were evasive, saying she's shy about walking. This soon eroded into outright defensiveness, and from there they went the sad route of trying everything, from specialists in pediatric orthopedics to Ask Dr. Gott. All the tests that money can buy have been run on Melinda. The doctors all say the same thing, that she is fine bone-wise and that every child has her own timetable. And still the McElroys entertain nervous visions of Melinda packing her bag someday and crawling off to college. Early on Friday afternoon, Lena called me from her office at Poison Headquarters. "What have you got for the rest of the day?" she asked. "Office hours," I said. "What's the chance some student will drop in?" "There's a chance," I said. I looked around my desk and considered the odds. I have ferns and bromelades in my office, a quietly carnivorous Darlingtonia, a terrarium full of the humid breath of mosses. I spend a good deal of time alone with them. A meteor could strike the science building, too, I said. I've traded shifts with Ursula so we can play hooky for the afternoon. Lena sounded breathless. We might as well enjoy our last hours of freedom before we take on the awesome responsibilities of a child, she said. Less than 10 minutes after hanging up the phone, she was honking the horn outside my office. We set out for the Covered Bridge Festival. I should explain that this is not a festival in any normal sense, but a weekend during which the residents of southern Indiana drive about celebrating the fact that there are numerous covered bridges in the vicinity. One can enjoy them in any order. My own favorite is the one at Little Patoka on the Eel River. One of the pros, Lena said as she frowned slightly over the steering wheel, is that our schedules are so flexible. I could always arrange my shift on the poison line around your classes. Assuming your staff doesn't all have a crisis at once. There will always be Ursula, she said. Ursula was a good friend of Lena's, a widow in her 60s, and the only other member of the poison hotline team who had neither procreated nor cleaved from his or her spouse in the previous year. Think of it, she said. It's perfect. On the days you have evening classes, I could work days. The other days, I could work nights. And when would we talk to each other, I asked. On weekends, and whenever you've taken poison. I'm now going to skip the description of Little Patoka and the festival, which has some street vendors and some people selling eggplants and tomatoes and beautiful lush vegetables, and one person selling lapis lazuli, which is a stone, and it matches Lena's eyes exactly in color, and it's the shape and size of her eyes. They don't buy it. And the other funny line in this bit is that he says about Lena, at one time she was torn between a career in poison and something more literary. So at the end of that, do you know that Ron Emerson and Gracie are separated, she asked. She knew Ron from the hospital, and Gracie had worked as a secretary in my department before taking maternity leave. That's something new, I said, a baby and a split up. I know, it's almost like divorce is some kind of virus going around, and there's no vaccine you can take. But for a while, it looked like babies might be the antidote. But I now know that isn't true. We were in sight of the covered bridge now, in the long row of trees that marked the course of the Eel River. Lots of people are like Ron and Gracie, Lena went on. If they're in trouble to begin with, then after a baby, they don't have a prayer of working things out. There's never time. I didn't offer an opinion. I was content to walk beside Lena and hold her hand while she thought this through to the end. My own thoughts were completely different. I was thinking that I belonged in this place, among these fields and rivers and covered bridges. I have spent my entire life in small Indiana towns. I grew up in one, was educated in another, and settled at last in a third. My sisters come to visit from far-flung cities where they enjoy extraordinary foods and philharmonic orchestras, Seattle, Atlanta, Cleveland, and they say that looking back, they can't imagine how they lived with such limited opportunities. I suppose I accept these limitations without much question. There are always surprises. I was raised in a home of harsh religion and more children than there should have been. And I grew up expecting little in the way of affection, much less Lena. To my mind, a life spent among burgeoning fields is not necessarily a life of limitations. On the other hand, Lena said, it's scary to think of being old and having missed the chance. I guess it's reasonable to want to pass yourself on. It's the nearest thing to living to get forever. In a genetic matter of speaking, I said. But then, I'm sure my parents thought 3 kids were enough to guarantee them immortality, and it may not turn out that way, said Lena. Lena was her family's only hope of passing on its DNA. There was the sister who had died, and a much younger brother who became sterile in his teens as a complication of mumps. He and his wife recently adopted Korean twins. To the great credit of my in-laws, never put pressure on Lena. They are uncommon people who love their children without possessiveness or a need to interfere. They astonish me continually, and yet Lena doesn't seem to appreciate what she has. She reads the books, like everyone else, on how to overcome the heartbreak of a dysfunctional family, and then says things like, "Well, you know, my grandfather Butler did drink." I suppose it's like being beautiful. When every other woman on earth is lamenting this or that physical flaw, you can't very well admit you don't have any. But it bothers me sometimes that she takes this love for granted, as if everyone in the world had parents who'd call up while you're out for a birthday dinner and sing the happy birthday song in three-part harmony, counting the dog, into your answering machine. My own parents are still living, like Lena's, but they do not communicate. They once communicated over issues surrounding their children, and then they communicated over which channel to watch. Now they have bought a second television set, smaller than the first, and the two stand side by side. My father sits in a chair next to my mother's in the evenings and watches the sports without sound. We reached the bridge. Lena dropped my hand and walked ahead of me without speaking. When a bridge reaches this age, it's important to listen to what it has to say to you as you walk through it. The river below our feet made a wistful, continuous sigh, and our steps were like whispers. The wood of the floorboards was soft with age and had the dusty smell that carries for me all the confused nostalgia of youth and barns. When we came out the other side, the day seemed brighter. Sunlight picked out the colors of the trees on the opposite bank of the river. "Look at this," Lena said, "Beauty and the Beast all rolled into one." It was a remarkable caterpillar, the size, shape, and color of a bright kosher dill, with blue suction cups for feet and yellow knobs on its back. It was creeping up one of the bridge's structural timbers, and Lena was entranced. "What's it going to be when it grows up?" she asked. Insects were not my department, but Lena always placed absolute faith in my knowledge of the natural world, and for this reason I read a great deal. "A cecropia moth," I guessed. "I don't know anything else that would warrant a caterpillar that big." She looked up. Over our heads were unpainted eaves, sheltered by the tin roof of the bridge, and a full archaeological record of barn swallow nests. "Do you think it's going up there right now to make its cocoon?" I assessed the caterpillar's rate of speed. "Maybe, by tomorrow afternoon." She watched it with intense concentration. "I wish I could weave a cocoon around myself and change into something beautiful," she said at last. I looked at Lena's profile, framed by an auburn halo of honey locust and red oak leaves, and the Eel River running forever away. "In heaven's name," I asked, "what would you change yourself into?" "Somebody more definite," she said, "the kind of person who's very sure on the inside of what she wants to be." As we walked back towards town, her spirit seemed to lift again. A dog ran up to us from nowhere, and Lena spoke to it in such an encouraging tone, I was sure it would follow us home. It did follow us, but only until a family with young children crossed our path going out toward the bridge. The dog was fully grown and even showed some gray around its muzzle, but it tripped and panted and seemed to have the intelligence of a puppy. "Can dogs be retarded?" she asked me, laughing, and then suddenly looked thoughtful. "Could Melinda be, do you think?" "No, I don't think so. They're just showing natural concern. Everybody is afraid their child will have something wrong with it. McElroy had told me that before Melinda was born, his wife forgot to turn off the electric blanket one night and spent the next 3 months worrying about brain damage to the fetus. I think I could handle it. Really, I do. Don't you?" With the toe of her boot, she kicked an apple that lay in the road. It rolled in a wide arc into the weeds. "What we're looking at is the prospect of a new person coming to live with us, right? And if we were placing an ad for a roommate, we wouldn't say, 'Imperfect or handicapped people will not be considered.'" "I never thought of it that way," I said. "What would be hard, though, is that it would take so much more effort than I've ever counted on over the long term, a lot more than a regular baby. One of us would probably have to give up our career. I suppose me." Why you? Is it something you'd be willing to do? I thought about this. Yes, I said. If we'd decided to commit ourselves to the project, then yes, I would. Lena looked at me with such surprise, I was overwhelmed by the wish that she knew me better. It isn't as though I hold back information. Usually I don't quite know how I feel about things until Lena asks, and often not even then. It's only logical, isn't it, I reasoned, if it comes down to a choice between teaching bryophyta and lycophyta or saving the lives of our youth, there's just no contest. And you would do that. She put her hand into my hip pocket and leaned on my shoulder as we walked. No matter whatever happens, I'm so happy you told me that. The lapis lazulis, the people with the lapis lazuli, had packed up and moved on by the time we reached their spot, but we resolved anyway to buy something to commemorate the day. We would acquire the two-headed Yolo Wonder at any price if it was for sale. It was a squash. Lena stopped at each table, weighing in her hands the acorn squash and noble ears of corn, and holding up small maroon apples for me to bite. She was wearing purple, a color that nearly glows when she puts it on, a purple sweater and a turquoise and lavender scarf. As I looked at her there among the pumpkins, I was overcome with color and the intensity of my life. In these moments, we are driven to try and hoard happiness by taking photographs, but I knew better. The important thing was what the color stood for, the taste of hard apples in the existence of Lena, and the exact quality of the sun on the last warm day in October. A photograph would have flattened the scene into a happy moment, whereas what I felt was gut rapture. The fleeting certainty that I deserved the space I'd been taking up on this earth and all the air I had breathed. There are a few things that predictably give me joy. Watching Lena's face while we make love is one. The appearance of the first new marble white tomatoes in my garden is another. And the break of comprehension across a student's face when I've planted an understanding that never grew in that mind before. I'm told that seeing one's own child born is an experience beyond description. But knowing these things, I can just begin to imagine. That evening, little Melinda might have been enlisted in a conspiracy to make us parents. She ate her dinner without complaint, then rubbed her eyes in a dreamy and charming way and went to bed. In the morning, she awoke, transmogrified. She sat in the middle of the living room floor and displayed her vocabulary in a dizzying, vengeful series of demands. Her dark hair was wild and her temper fierce. Most ferociously of all, she demanded Mommy, and over again, some mysterious item called Belinka. My will was soon crushed like a slave's, but Lena held on bravely. She brought out the whole suitcase of Melinda's animals and toys, which we had been instructed not to do. Just bring the things out one by one, her mother had advised, so she won't know this is all there is. And put on a puppet show as earnest as it was extemporaneous. Melinda was a cruel critic. She bit Lena on the hand and crawled off toward the kitchen. By noon, we were desperate. Kids are always soothed by the outdoors, Lena said, and I did not dare doubt the source of her knowledge. I packed cheese and fruit and cans of root beer in a picnic basket and would have thrown in a bottle of Jim Beam if we'd had it, while she called Ursula. She'll love the idea, Lena assured me. She's always complaining how she never sees her grandkids. Ursula lived 16 miles away on a declining apple orchard and cattle farm. It cost us several damaged fingers to get Melinda into her car seat, but she gratified us by instantly falling asleep. Do you think maybe it's different when they're your own? Lena whispered as we drove. I did not hazard a guess. The rural setting did seem to do some good. Melinda was no longer belligerent, only energetic. We carried her kicking and squirming and provided commentary on the cats and cow flops out to what Ursula called the June orchard. She'd hired a neighbor to keep a picnic spot mowed all summer for the benefit of her grandchildren on the remote chance that they might visit. Ursula led the way to her stout garden shoes, swinging the picnic basket and pointing out blighted trees, their knotted trunks oozing sweet sap and buzzing with insects. Lena was right. She needed company. We spread the blanket and laid out the food, cracked open soda cans, and bribed Melinda with grapes. Her speed was a problem. Having postponed walking for so long, her crawl was proficient beyond belief. "Honey, stay in the short grass. There are blackberry briars and stickery things out there," Lena warned, but Melinda continued to streak out for the high brush, like a wild thing seeking its origins. Between every two bites of my sandwich, I dragged her back by the legs. "Well, here's to the new generation," Lena said, raising her root beer. She drank a long gulp, throwing her head back. Then she stood up suddenly, gazed at me with a look of intent misery, and spat out something that twitched on the grass. Ursula and I both leaned forward to look. It was a hornet. We watched, stupefied, as Lena sank to her knees and then sat down and then lay full length on the ground. The valves of my heart slammed like doors. Anaphylactic shock is an impossible thing to expect from a human body, a defense mechanism that goes terribly wrong. Normally, the blood swells around a foreign protein to flush it away, but when that happens in every cell of the body at once, it looks from the outside like a horror movie. I looked around for Melinda. She had reached the edge of the clearing and stopped, looking back at us with fearful expectation. "Get her," I shouted at Ursula, "and get someone some help as fast as you can. If you need a car, take ours." I thrust the keys at her. Ursula knew as well as I did the urgency of the situation, but being the one with the most to lose, I suppose I needed to take command. Ursula scooped a hand under each of Melinda's armpits and ran for the house. I knelt beside Lena. Her face and throat were swollen, but she was breathing. "In my purse," Lena said quietly, and then she said nothing more, and I was afraid she was going to die. That those would be her last words, "in my purse." But then she said, with her eyes still closed, "That purple cloisonné case, get that." I did so, having no idea why. I fiddled frantically with the clasp and then nearly dropped it at the sight of what lay inside. There was a cool, hateful-looking needle and a glass bubble of clear liquid. Lena told me, in a businesslike way, except for occasional long pauses, how to attach the bubble to the needle, turn it once, and jab it into her arm. When I couldn't get her sleeve rolled up, she said to shoot it through the shirt. My hands were shaking. It was mostly out of an aversion for operations like this that I went into the study of plants, leaving flesh and blood to others. Almost immediately, she started to breathe more deeply. She lay still without opening her eyes, and I would have thought she was sleeping except for the tightness of her grip on my hand. "Have you always carried that?" I asked. She nodded. In three years of intimacy, I had never seen these secret instruments. I thought the case contained some feminine thing that wasn't my business. Face powder, maybe, or tampons. "You could have told me," I said. "I've lived all my life with this thing," she said, "and I tried to understand this, that some pains are our own." She said, "I didn't want you constantly worrying about it." I squeezed her hand to bring some strength into mine. I thought of the previous afternoon, of watching her, beautiful and permanent, against the continual loss of the Eel River. The things we will allow ourselves to believe. In the hospital, Lena's friend, Dr. Kavanaugh, warned me that although Lena was out of the woods, she was even more visibly swollen than when I had seen her last, and would remain so for a while. "It takes the body days," he said, "to reabsorb the fluids it releases in such haste." Before I pushed open the door to her room, I put in my mind the image of Lena swollen, but still I was startled. She didn't actually look like my wife, but like some moon-faced relative of Lena's. She smiled, turning the moon to a sun. Does that hurt? I asked, sitting cautiously beside her thigh under the sheet. Does what hurt? I don't know, your face. It looks stretched. Gee, thanks, she said, laughing. She took my wrist and laid her fingers lightly across my veins. Her hands were still Lena's hands, slender and gracefully curved. In bygone days, they would have been the fingers of a movie star curled around a cigarette. Where's Melinda? She asked suddenly, almost sitting up but restrained by the sheet that was drawn across her chest and tucked into the bed. Ursula has her. They're getting along like knaves. You know what I think? Immortality is the wrong reason, she said. And suddenly there were two streams of tears on her shiny cheeks. Having a child wouldn't make you immortal. It would make you twice as mortal. It's just one more life you could possibly lose besides your own. Two more eyes to be put out, 10 more toes to get caught under the mower. Lena's grandfather Butler had lost some toes under a lawnmower once, and of course, there was her lost sister. You're just scared right now. In a few weeks, life will seem secure again, I said. Maybe it will, but that won't change the fact that it isn't. She looked at me, and I knew she was right, and I knew that for the first time she felt sure she would not bear children. I felt a mixture of relief and confusion. This was the opposite of the reaction I'd expected. I thought brushes with death made people want children desperately. My younger brother and his wife were involved in a near disaster on a ski lift in northern Wisconsin, and within 48 hours they'd conceived their first son. You're full of drugs, I said, cortisone and Benadryl and who knows what else, all that stuff I shot into your arm. Epinephrine, she said, you did a good job. Did Kavanaugh tell you? That's what saved me. She stroked my hand and turned it over, palm down. The wedding band stood out against the white hospital sheets like an advertisement for jewelry and true love and all that is coveted in the world. What I'm saying is, I said, this isn't the time to be making important decisions. Your head isn't clear. A lot of things have happened. Why do people always say that? My head is clear because of what happened. She laid her head back on the pillow and looked at the ceiling. The white forelock still bloomed above her forehead, but her beauty had gone underground. Dark depressions hung like hammocks under her eyes. I realized now that I had the answer to a ridiculous question that had haunted me for years, concerning whether or not I would still love Lena if she weren't beautiful. Just being married, just loving one other person with all your heart is risky enough, she said. This I knew. I lay down, carefully, on the bed, not with her, but beside her, with my head against the white sheet, that on some other day might be drawn up to cover a face. By Sunday evening, Lena was discharged on the promise that she would take it easy. She knew about the complex medications she needed to take. There was no problem there. She spent her days explaining antidotes. Once we'd gotten settled, Ursula brought Melinda over. It was several hours before the McElroys were due to arrive, but I told Ursula I'd manage, and I did. Melinda's energy seemed spent, and perhaps the slight pall over the house made her feel as though she had done something wrong. She sat by the hearth in the living room, driving a Barbie doll over the bricks in a dump truck. I was reading Darwin. Occasionally, I read short passages aloud to Melinda, and she seemed to appreciate this. Nature, read in tooth and claw, I told her, is only one way to look at it. The principal difference between children and adults, I believe, is that children accomplish their greatest feats with little or no fanfare. Melinda looked at me strangely, then stood up and took 5 careful steps, and then sat down with a bump. I called out to Lena. She walked! What? Lena appeared at the door in her white robe. Melinda walked. She took 5 steps from there to here. A doubtful look at Lena's face, which was slowly regaining its original shape and becoming easier for me to read. Are you positive? She asked. Melinda looked gravely back and forth between us, apparently fearing she'd made another unknown mistake. Oh, honey, we're so proud of you, Lena said, crossing the room to pick her up. Melinda's knees spread automatically to straddle Lena's hip, and as she kissed the top of the baby's head, my throat grew tight, seeing how right this looked. Lena was a mother waiting to happen. Both Lena and Melinda were asleep by the time the McElroys arrived, which was probably just as well. Melinda might have been expected to give a repeat performance, and Lena's face would have given away the nature of our catastrophic weekend. I didn't tell them the whole story, only that Lena wasn't feeling well. There would be time later to go into it. For now, I didn't want to dampen the thrill of Melinda's having walked. They did not doubt my word for a minute, nor did they seem disappointed that they weren't there to witness it. They were unconditionally elated. So was Melinda. She collapsed groggily into her mother's arms, a warrior weary from battle. I fell into bed beside Lena with similar relief. Our house was our own again. We were ourselves. What I really think, Lena said suddenly, long after I'd turned out the light, is that having children is the most normal thing in the world. But not for us, because we're not in a normal situation. I haven't been facing up to it, but really, I could go at any time, and it wouldn't be fair to saddle you with that kind of responsibility. Don't think about what's fair to me, I said. Think about what you want. I am, she said. This is what I want. She turned over and faced me in the darkness. You are. The light from the window behind Lena outlined the curve of her cheek with a silver line like a new moon. I felt a strangeness in my chest, as though the muscles of my heart had suffered 1,000 tiny lacerations and were leaking out pain. You sure? I asked. I'm sure. I pulled Lena into my arms and held her tightly, thinking of strange things, of diatomaceous earth and insects and the choices we make, and of eggplants, purple and bright in the sun.
People have magic with words, don't they? They have the same words that I have, but they put them together so well.
Yeah, doesn't she?
You can see all that. Beautifully done.
She really is spectacular, I think, as an author. She's written a few other things. This is a book of short stories called Homeland and Other Stories. She's written something called The Bean Trees and another novel called Pigs in Heaven, both of which I recommend.
Animal Dreams.
That's right. I knew I was forgetting one of her books. That's a wonderful book, Animal Dreams.
Animals and pigs animals. And fruits and vegetables.
The strange titles, Animal Dreams. It takes some work to read. I mean, you know, you need to pay attention to all these details, but I was just entranced by that.
Yeah. And here at the end, we had the crescent moon on her cheek. I mean, all this, the layers of symbols in this book are really, in this story, are really quite nice. The seasons and the... What was your bet, three paragraphs before the end? Are they going to have... Were they going to do it or not? She was a mother waiting...
Three paragraphs before the end and ask us, because now yeah. It's hard to remember.
I thought when she picked the child up and he said she's a mother waiting to happen.
That way. Mm-hmm.
And then when he said that his heart felt like it had 1,000 lacerations and was leaking pain, which was the diatomaceous earth image again of all those little tiny lacerations like happened to insects. Then I thought, well, they'll decide to have a child. And something in me said, yes. And then they moved the other way. And I thought, well, that's probably better for them. But my son has the same thing with bees. He's going to have kids. So it isn't that makes the decision. I mean, that's what she gave the decision to.
Not really. Well, when they tossed that health thing in, or the potential health thing, then that threw us a curve, because I was working on trying to figure out just a young couple, should they or shouldn't they, in this modern day when you got careers, and that it really is tough to have a baby and try to work it all out. But then that health thing, that really is, it does add a piece
mm-hmm.
that makes it more difficult.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to figure out symbolisms in there. His life is wrapped up in how the spore reaches the fruit and mm-hmm. the creation of life, and her life is wrapped up in saving lives.
Antidotes.
Pardon?
Antidotes.
Yeah. Both of which are such parental things, almost in reverse. I mean, it's usually the, you know, and biologically the mother is the locus of the egg that becomes the, and well, both parents save children, saving lives from poisons, but they were doing parent things,
mm-hmm.
regardless of not having children right away through.
And they look so deeply into the heart of things, it seems to me. I mean, this man does, anyhow. He's such an interesting man. You want him to be a father because he's so thoughtful and funny and, you know.
But interesting that that's a man who was created by a woman. Right? And by Barbara Kingsolver.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Not that there aren't men like that.
I was going to say, you mean that's not real?
Well, when I wasn't saying she made up a man who couldn't exist, what I meant was, I don't know what I meant.
That's kind of father possibility she put there.
Yeah.
She did a lot with generations. I mean, she described each of their previous families. She, Lena, came from a family where the two parents were loving, raised the child and let the child go, didn't try to control her, didn't try to control the others, did not seem to be destroyed by the death of their daughter by a bee sting, we know, which would, some of us would poison us to death. We would die of the pain of that. And the only, you know, when she tried to get involved in conversations about dysfunctional families, the only thing she could say is that one of her grandfathers drank, not even that he drank to excess. And then the man, this lovely man that Barbara Kingsolver has created, who is a professor in an Indiana college, came from a family that was difficult and where he never got enough love and where he felt they had too many children and where, I've forgotten, there was another problem in his family. But he was not a happy camper in his. The grandparents on that side would not have been so. They're the grandparents that sit watching televisions, two televisions side by side, one with the sound off.
Didn't his grandpa have his toes cut off in a lawnmower?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was worried about the new baby maybe having to worry about that.
Uh-huh. It's two people to worry about, not only your beloved partner, but also your child could have their toes cut off in the lawnmower.
So back and forth he went.
Yeah.
So I think when you go, you've got kids, and you're up to your neck in problems with kids. And you look around and you see people who don't have kids, or people who've had their kids, and you're up and running. Gee, that looks fun, you know? Mm-hmm. And it looks like, boy, you know, there's so much we could do. There's so much we could do together. There's certainly that. I mean, I know some couples who haven't had children who have had very productive lives and have been able to do things because of not having children. But there's also something they don't get, you know, that you just can't get it in a way. It's kind of getting bathed in life. It's hard to get it in a way. and have children. So, and a lot of people are lucky enough to have both, have time together and have children. But once they have children, the agenda changes forever.
Yeah, they said it's like the boat sinking and spending 18 years treading water or swimming, or it's probably longer than 18 years, I'm afraid.